Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor-in-chief of the New Books Network, and I don't know about you, but I have a long list of books that I think I really should read or that I want to read. It was in this connection that I was particularly glad to learn about Blinkist. What Blinkist does is it takes thousands of best-selling nonfiction books and it distills them down to their most important elements so that you can read or listen to them in under 15 minutes, and you can do it on your phone or your portable device. I listen to Blinkist while I'm working at my computer, doing the kind of thing that really doesn't involve my brain. The Blinkist library is massive. It has 2,500 titles, and they're always adding new ones. There are a lot of classics, you know, for example, How to Win Friends and Influence People. And there are also a lot of Amazon bestsellers on it. For example, there's a book called The Subtle Art of Not Giving. I can't say this on the air, but it's a word that starts with F. And then there are a lot of history books that I think that you, as listeners to New Books in History, would be very interested in. For example, there's David Christian's, I'm a big David Christian fan, Origin Story, A Big History of Everything. Daniel Ellsberg, you know who Daniel Ellsberg is. He wrote a book called The Doomsday Machine, Confessions of a Nuclear War Planner, which is fascinating. I listened to that on Blinkist. And then there are a lot of biographies. I really like listening to biographies on Blinkist. Alexander the Great by Philip Freeman. Genghis Khan by Jack Weatherford. Leonardo da Vinci by Walter Isaacson. Right now, for a limited time, Blinkist has a special offer just for the NBN audience. If you go to Blinkist.com/newbooks, you can start a free 7-day trial. That's Blinkist, spelled B-L-I-N-K-I-S-T. Blinkist.com/newbooks to start a free 7-day trial. You can cancel anytime. Blinkist.com/newbooks. And they will sign you up, and you can find out whether this is something that you would enjoy. I know that I enjoy it, and I highly recommend it to you. I hope you enjoy the following interview.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to New Books and Biography, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Mark Klobis, your host for the channel. Today, I'm talking with Patrick Fulangshan about his biography of the first president of the Chinese Republic, entitled Yuan Shikai, A Reappraisal. Patrick, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me today.
Well, thank you for agreeing to join us today. I was wondering if you could start us off by telling us something about yourself.
Oh, my name is Patrick Shan. I'm a professor teaching Chinese history, East Asian history, and of course, world history at Grand Valley State University in Michigan.
You are a professor who specializes in the subject, but what led you to write a biography of Yuan Shikai in particular?
Yuan Shikai was a very important historical figure in modern China because he symbolizes the transition from empire to republic. However, in the past 100 years, only one biography was published on him. That was published in 1961, almost 60 years ago. So there is an urgent need to write another critical, interpretive, analytical biography of Yuan Shikai in a new century for the new readers.
It's surprising that there's been so little done about him, given both his importance and the controversy surrounding him. And one of the things that you do in your book, I noticed, is you really point to how the interpretations of him have really evolved over the past century since his death.
Yes, indeed. His image in Chinese literature, Chinese culture, and Chinese history has have been very negative ever since his death in 1916. However, ever since Deng Xiaoping's reform since 1978, particularly since the 1990s, the Chinese began to value his contribution to Chinese history in late 19th century and early 20th century. So indeed, there was a big change in terms of his image in the past 100 years. Particularly, the change took place in the past 30 years.
Perhaps we should begin by talking a bit about who Yuan Shikai was and by looking at his early years, his childhood. What were his beginnings and how did he start out in public life?
Yuan Shikai was born in 1859 in Xiangcheng, Henan province. And his family was an elite family because that family produced a lot of bureaucrats for the Chinese Empire, the last empire, Qing Empire. So he benefited from this kind of social political network for his future career. So, however, he didn't go through the normal channels as many Chinese did at that time, because there was a civil service examination for any intellectual to go through in order to land a job in a government. And he didn't do that, and he rather joined the army and became a commissioner in Korea, and then became a bureaucrat of Chinese Empire in the late 19th century and early 20th century. So his beginning was a member of elite family. And that indeed is a very important social network for him to go through in the future.
It was a very interesting career path for him. And I was thinking about it as I was reading it, when you contrast that with the traditional career path for leadership in China, outside, of course, being the emperor himself, which is you would take the exams and you would rise up through the imperial bureaucracy. And Yuan Shikai didn't do that. He had this rather different career path, which took him through the military. And yet it seems that given the events that took place in the late 19th and early 20th century, in some ways that made him better prepared for dealing with the challenges that China was facing during that time than if he had gone through the more traditional route of learning the Confucian classics and passing the exams and ascending that route, which had been in place for 1,500 years.
Yes, that's a good point, indeed. The civil service examination system started, written one, started during the Sui Tang Dynasty, almost 13, 14 centuries ago. So that it was a channel for Chinese Empire to select talents to fill the vacancies in the government. So one Western scholar even termed this examination system as literocracy. That means the scholars rule over the empire. Indeed, if we study the Chinese imperial rule from Sui Tang Dynasty down to Qing Dynasty, you can find a large group of talented scholars ruling different levels of governments. However, the civil service examination narrowly focused on the classic works, Confucian classic works. So there is no emphasis to science, technology, mathematics, and so forth. So in the late 19th century, the Chinese began to blame that system for China's problems. So that's why eventually it was abolished in 1905. So Yuan Shikai didn't go through that channel. Instead, he went through the channels of army, foreign service, then training a fresh army. So his path was very different from majority, overwhelming majority of Chinese bureaucrats at that time. But as I just said, his own path was very unique. And when he was walking through this path, he gained experience in running the administration, running the government, in training the army. He got a rich experience that enabled him to be a very talented bureaucrat, probably better than many successful candidates who went through the civil service examination.
I was also thinking about another aspect of this very practical education he received, which was in dealing with China's place vis-a-vis the other powers. And I felt that really started to come out in his time in Korea. And I was wondering if we could perhaps delve a bit more deeply into that period of his life. How does he end up in Korea, and what role does he play in Korea during that time there?
Oh, Korea, for a thousand years, was a tributary state of the Chinese Empire. So that means Korea needed the Chinese imperial protection and needed a Chinese imperial endorsement. And every year or every other year, the King of Korea would send a mission to Chinese capital to present a gift to Chinese emperor. That means a tribute. And in return, certainly they receive more tribute from Chinese emperor. This is a special arrangement between China and its neighbors, such as Korea, Vietnam, and several other Asian states nearby. So those small states never claim to be empire. So they recognize Chinese emperor as their emperor. So this is like an informal empire for China. And in this way, China influenced those neighbors, Korea, Vietnam, and several other states in Southeast Asia. So the reason why Yuan Shikai was in Korea was that there was rebellion, there was a coup d'etat in Korea in 1882. So he just went along with his army, and he was there to crush the coup d'etat. And once again, in 1884, he crushed another coup d'etat. So the two moves enable him to build a reputation, and those two events also enable him to gain footing in a foreign nation. So that's why he became imperial commissioner on behalf of Chinese Empire in Korea, working for the benefit of Chinese Empire to strengthen the traditional tributary relationship between the two countries. So Korea, of course, was independent, but Yuan Shikai in Korea tried to strengthen the traditional tributary relationship in order to prevent the powers of penetration, invasion, and aggression, particularly from Japan. So he did a very good job for those 10 years. However, in the year 1894, the first Sino-Japanese War started. So basically, ultimately, I would say that his nation failed.
I was thinking that his experience in dealing with the Japanese in Korea probably hammered home to him that importance of having a modern, for lack of a better word, westernized military. To what degree did his involvement, his experience in Korea mark him out as somebody that the imperial government wanted to put in charge of that modernization project after the first Sino-Japanese War?
Oh, very good point. As a matter of fact, Korea was a testing ground for Yuan Shikai to experiment with many of his projects for modernization. For example, he trained a modern army for Korean King. So that could be seen as the first step for him as military commander to train the first Chinese army after Sino-Japanese War. And he helped Korea to implement many policies by influencing the monarch, the government, and the Korean people. And he also promoted the economic relationship between China and Korea. So I would argue that Korea was a testing ground for Yuan Shikai's future career. And it was in Korea that he gained rich experience. And he would carry on the legacy to his future career in China after he returned to China in the year 1894.
So what exactly does he do in terms of modernizing the Chinese military? Is it a widespread modernization, or is it more focused on building something from the ground up?
Oh, that's an excellent question. He got the job to train a Chinese army in the year 1895, soon after the first Sino-Japanese War ended. So that was the first modernized army. So why I use the word modernized? Because he equipped his army with Western military equipment. He invited a German and even one Norwegian military instructor to come over by paying them a high salary to train this army in Xiaozhan, which is not far from Tianjin, not far from Beijing. And he was there for almost 4 years. So during those 4 years, he indeed trained this first Chinese modern army. And he welcomed many Western diplomats and Western military commanders to come over to observe his military training. And many of the Western military commanders praised him for being the father of the first Chinese army, modernized army.
One of the things that I noticed when I was reading that section was that his role in training those men seems to have won them a considerable amount of loyalty. And this gets to something that we'll probably address a little bit later in the podcast about this perception of him as of Yuan Shikai as a warlord. But I was thinking, to what degree does what were some of the things that he did as during this period that really marked him out in terms of moving on? I mean, was he just popular with his men? Was he winning their esteem? Or was he also winning the approval of the government in Beijing as well?
Oh, excellent question. And the loyalty ultimately should be given to the emperor. In the imperial period, before the collapse of Qing Empire in 1912. So all people living the empire should be loyal to the emperor without exception. The soldiers under Yuan Shikai should pay their loyalty to the emperor. And from the primary sources, you can see that he emphasizes that. However, he implemented a strict discipline. So in that way, he built a very strong bond with his soldiers. He had a very good memory. He knew the names of the soldier. At that time, the size of the military was not very large, only probably 6,000-7,000 men, that's it. So he did a very good job to train them. And he even wrote books for instructing the soldiers to be modernized troops. So in the long run, however, those army, indeed, after collapse of the empire, they were loyal to him, indeed. So that is a power base for his future career, which is called the Beiyang clique.
And that's a clique we'll be returned to because you talk about how it plays its political role after 1911 that is both important and also underutilized. What was it just his success as a military reformer that marked him out for his period of governorship that followed, or were there other factors at play as well?
Oh, Yuan Shikai was a talented, versatile man. His experience is not restricted to military. Indeed, he trained the first modern army in Xiaozhan. And later on, he became a governor of Shandong province. Later on, became a governor general of Zili province. So he implemented many of his progressive policies and measures in those two provinces. And when he accepted as a governor, when he accepted governorship, those two provinces were ruined by rebellions, foreign invasions. But he did a very good job by turning those two provinces into model provinces throughout the Qing Empire. So with that, we can argue that his legacy is not only restricted to military field, but also in his administration, in his official management, in his economic reform, cultural advancement, and many industrial development, and many, many others.
This period of his life is also where you start getting into some of the controversies. And I was thinking, for example, his handling of the Boxer Rebellion. And I was wondering if you could perhaps elaborate upon that a little bit, because I felt it was an episode in your book that really highlighted a lot of the tensions that were played, both in terms of the politics of the time and in terms of that subsequent reputation that was oftentimes seen, often unfairly, as being very negative.
Yes, indeed. In the past decades, ever since his death, the Chinese people condemned him for suppressing the Boxer Uprising. The Boxers were illiterate peasants. They were motivated by their patriotism, indeed, because of foreign aggression and invasion into China. They simply targeted the foreigners without discrimination, without any clear policy. They simply kill a lot of foreigners, including missionaries and merchants and travelers. So this is a typical form of xenophobic nationalism. So Yuan Shikai took the position as governor in Shantung. The first thing he need to do is to suppress Boxer Uprising. He did. He killed many thousand Boxers in his province. That's why Boxer moved to Zili province instead of Shandong. Shandong became very peaceful under his governorship because his suppression of the Boxer Uprising. So after so many decades of condemnation against Yuan Shikai in terms of suppressing Boxer Uprising, in the past years, just recently, some scholar began to press him for pacifying land, maintaining stability of the province, and by building a relationship with Germans, because Germans colonized one part of the Shantung Peninsula. And so that's why after 2 years of his governorship, Shantung was a peaceful world. If you examine another nearby province like Zili or Henan or Shanxi, those provinces were damaged by foreign expedition forces. So he did a good job in Shantung. So that's why the suppression of Boxer Uprising was assessed differently in the past 100 years.
Yeah, I was thinking, because as you point out, though, that his success came at a price, and the price was he was being condemned by a lot of these nationalists as being a lackey of the foreigners. And it shows this, I thought it did a nice job of illuminating this reputational tightrope that he's walking, where to be successful in many respects oftentimes opened him up to these charges that he was, you know, serving foreign masters in which which, as you explain, is, you know, part of this environment in China at the time. But at the same time, since then, we've really, there's this appreciation that, you know, he was doing his job as governor to deal with an uprising that was not, you know, that was in many respects challenging the imperial regime as much as it was the foreigners.
Yeah, good point. The people labeled him as a lackey of imperial powers, mainly because he reached accommodation with the Germans. The German colonized the Qingdao area. That is one of the most beautiful cities in China, and built a colonial authority over there. So that does not mean that Yuan Shikai surrendered to Germans. He deployed his troops around Qingdao from many different sides. The Germans cannot make any bold move on the Shandong Peninsula. At the same time, he suppressed the Boxer Uprising. I don't think he surrendered to Germans, but he prepared for any German invasion. In that way, he indeed made Shandong a peaceful world. So was that evidence to show he was lackey of imperial powers? Probably not so. And he prepared for the war against the German. But eventually, there was peace. And for that, in recent years, the Chinese scholars began to praise him for stabilizing the province, at the same time enforcing a lot of progressive policies over there.
Could you elaborate a little on some of the progressive policies that he came to be associated with? What was he doing in terms of trying to change China?
Oh, During his governorship, he, for example, implemented many progressive policies. So one of them was his promotion of modern education. And he tried to build a Western-style education system in China, first in Shandong. And then he built the first university, provincial university in the whole of China. That evolved into Shandong University today. So that's one of them. He promoted industry over there. He also implemented his policy to make Chinese government and the Chinese government officials more efficient. And he built one academy to train officials to learn about Western learning. That means science and the Western judicial system, Western even language and the Western political system. So in that way, he tried to open up China to the West. So those should be seen as progressive. And indeed, many scholars today view those as progressive policies.
Were they influential in terms of his selection as an imperial minister after his time as a governor general? Or was it his military role, or was it a combination of both?
Oh, his achievement in Shandong province certainly was a factor for him to be chosen as governor general of Zili and also Beiyang minister. So in those positions, after 1901, we can say that he became a state leader. So indeed, his feats, his achievements and, in Shandong Peninsula, in Shandong province, enable him to land the higher job in the future. So, yes.
What role did he play in the imperial government during that period that he was serving in Beijing?
Wow. He was foreign minister, which the foreign ministry was built just a few years ago to handle foreign affairs. I don't think he achieved a lot in that position. He was in that position but shortly, but he was one member of the Junjicu Military Affairs Council. In the West, we simply call it a council. So that council is the highest organ of government during the Qing Empire. He was one member of that. That means during later Qing Dynasty, he made a lot of decisions along with many other council members. So he was one of the state leaders in later Qing Dynasty.
You mentioned that his time as the foreign minister was fairly short. What led it to come to an end?
Oh, he was kicked out from the government in early 1909. Look, Qing Empire was ruled by the Manchu. Okay, the Manchu were ethnic group from Manchuria, from northeastern China. They conquered China in the year 1644. They ruled over China for almost three centuries. And this is the last page of the Qing Empire. And Yuan Shikai was not Manchu. He was Han Chinese. So in the late stage of the empire, the empire encountered a lot of problems, economically, politically, and many, many other issues. One of the problems was anti-Manchu revolutionary movement led by Sun Yat-sen from overseas, from the south. So there is a distrust between Manchu and Han Chinese. So that's why in 1909, early 1909, so Yuan Shikai was sacked. He was kicked out of the government. He retired from the government. He lived ever since in his home province, Henan province.
So how does he go from being retired to becoming provisional president of China in a matter of just a few months?
Yeah, he was kicked out in early 1901. And he came out after 1911 revolution. It's matter almost 3 years. During those 3 years, he lived, in his words, as a recluse in Anyang, northern Henan province, which is not far from Beijing. And he still maintained contacts with many officials, and many Chinese expected him to re-rise as an official in the government, because he's talented, he has experience, he was reasonable, he was rational, and he most importantly accumulated rich experience in the past decade. So indeed, after the breakout of 1911 revolution, the Qing government invited him to be back. His job was to suppress the revolution.
So how does he go from being tasked with suppressing the revolution to, in a sense, leading it?
Right. That is a very interesting question. He was invited, he was ordered to be a governor general of Huguang, that is in the Hubei province, where the revolution started. An uprising occurred on October the 10th, 1911, which started 1911 revolution. And Yuan Shikai was assigned with a job to suppress revolution. But the issue is, he was out of the government for 3 years. He demanded the support from imperial government, and he also have some other demands for his military operation as well. When those demands were satisfied, he went to the front. Indeed, he ordered his troops to attack revolutionary. He took over several regions in Wuhan area, such as Hankou and Hanyang. But to cross the Yangtze River Valley to attack Wuchang was a very hard job. So also, he sacrificed a lot of soldiers in those two battles. So he cannot venture into Wuchang by crossing the Yangtze River Valley. So that's why he began to negotiate with the revolutionary. So that negotiation lasted for many months. And eventually, through this kind of negotiation, the revolution tended to be, as Chinese call it, bloodless revolution. Unlike revolution in Russia or in France, which were very bloody, Chinese revolution in 1911 and 1912 tended to be bloodless. Indeed, people shed blood in Hankou, Hanyang, but the future negotiation peacefully settled the problem. That means the empire collapsed by a peaceful abdication, and a republic would be built. In this kind of a process, Yuan Shikai at first supported the Qing Empire. From the primary sources, we can find that. Eventually, however, he became the first president of China through this kind of political compromise and peaceful negotiation.
So initially, as you explain, he's a provisional president. What does he do during that time as the provisional president? And to what degree does it, in effect, shape the emergence of this new republic?
Oh, excellent question. Yeah. From the time when the imperial court abdicated in early 1912, later 1913, he served as a provisional president. But he was elected. Sun Yat-sen's provisional government in Nanjing had a Senate. According to the rule set by Sun Yat-sen, the future provisional president would be elected by Senate, by the legislature. And Yuan Shikai was elected by that body. And then he was empowered by the last royal family to organize a republic. So this is a very unique but a strange political compromise. In this kind of very special milieu, Yuan Zhikai became the provisional president of China. So what did he do in that 1 year and a half? He did a lot. He tried to unify the country. He tried to implement a lot of progressive policies. He tried to promote education. He tried to seek a further political reconciliation with revolutionary, with many other different factions. But second revolution broke out in the summer of 1913. He crushed the revolution. So after he became president in later 1913, he even outlawed his rival political party, that's Nationalist Party. And the next year, he even disbanded the Congress. So he did a lot during his provisional presidency. Many could be seen as progressive, but at the same time, he tried to consolidate his power, and which was condemned by many historians.
One of the things you do in this section of the book that I thought was very illuminating is you describe the context, how when Yuan Zhikai comes to power, he's described as the George Washington of China, and that's something I think that gets to both his military background and this expectation of the role he's going to play. And I was especially struck by a parallel that you don't really stress in the book, but it's there, which is how, like George Washington, Yuan Zhikai initially doesn't associate with political parties. He has that attitude of how he is the president of all of China and cannot really be seen as being a faction of it. And yet, as you point out, in many ways, that is a weakness that contributes to a lot of his problems for his time as the chief executive of China.
When he became a provisional president of China in early 1912, both North, which formerly was under control of the imperial court, and the South, which was under the influence of the revolutionary led by Sun Yat-sen. So in when the imperial abdication occurred, both in the South held Yuan Zhikai as Chinese George Washington. Many primary sources contain that kind of title. And people believe that he would be the man to rebuild Chinese society, to defend the Chinese Republic, and he would have served as Chinese George Washington. So that is the expectation of the people at that moment in early 1912. In the next 1 year and a half, particularly in the next 1 year, very few people condemn him, and people try to be optimistic about the future of China. They believe that this is the first democracy, this is the first republican system. People are very happy with that, and all power players are very happy with that situation. And so from reading many primary sources, I cannot find many negative words about Yuan Zhikai. People had a very high hope for his presidency, but eventually he let people down, unfortunately.
What brought about that shift in terms of his declining popularity and his growing alienation?
His policy to concentrate power in his hands, particularly in 1915, began to draw criticism. And in particular, his efforts to restore an imperial system in early 1916. Wow, that was condemned by many Chinese. And the image began to shift from positive to negative, I would say. That happened in 1915, and particularly in early 1916. So during his first few years, many people supported him. And the only political party that probably didn't cooperate with him was the Nationalist Party, the party led by Sun Yat-sen, and by a future certainly a leader Chiang Kai-shek in 1920s. Certainly that happened long after Yuan Zhikai's death. So there is a shift. I think the shift occurred in later 1915 and early 1916.
Why did he undertake a step that ended up being so alienating for him in terms of his position, and one that ultimately created so much stress for him that it likely contributed to his death?
The one reason for his concentration of power, according to some scholars' interpretation, was his lack of national revenue. So that's why he had to borrow money from foreign banks in order to live. So that is a tragedy for him as the leader of China. So he tried to levy tax, but local military leaders and local officials sometimes didn't contribute anything to his government. Furthermore, this is a continuity of Chinese imperial decay. And the Chinese economy at that time was in very bad shape. And when he served as a provisional president of China, the total income for his government, according to one source, was only 10% of that of the Qing Empire. Think about that. Without concentration of power, so how can he get revenue? He cannot live on a foreign loan forever. So according to some scholars' interpretation, need to concentrate power. But that meant resistance. And it's not easy to be the leader of China at that time.
Concentration of power is one thing, and you have this good description in the book explaining how thinking of him as applying the word dictator is probably more than is really warranted in the Western conception of it. Why does he decide to take that step to actually try to establish a new emperorship, and why does it fail?
Some scholar used dictatorship to portray his rule over China. But if you compare his rule with the future Chinese leader like Chiang Kai-shek or Mao Zedong, probably his rule was not a dictatorship. So that's why I use the words centralism to portray his political maneuvers. And why he crowned himself as emperor, that's a very good question. There was like a movement in 1915, particularly in the summer of 1915, led by Yang Du, a very important official in the government and a very talented scholar. He studied in Japan and returned to China as a high-ranking official. He launched this kind of movement to restore imperial system. He has a belief that republican system doesn't work for China because Chinese have a long tradition of imperial rule, and China didn't get used to Western-style democracy. Democracy is good, but the republican system is good. But China at this moment cannot simply be a republic, cannot simply be a democracy. So that's why Yang Du believed that China should be a constitutional monarchy, with a monarch ruling the country, but he has no power, and then the real power would be in the hands of the prime minister. So this is another kind of democracy. And Yang Du tried to build this kind of a constitutional monarchy in China. He was a driving force for Yuan Zhikai's restoration of imperial system. And his son certainly wanted to be the next monarch. His son, Yuan Keding, support that too. So some foreign foreigners also support Yuan Zhikai's maneuver for being the emperor. And they believe that China was not ready to be a democracy. China was not ready to be a republic. So there is a very unique social-political milieu that gave Yuan Zhikai the chance to crown himself as emperor.
How successful was that effort?
Oh, that was a total failure. He proclaimed to be emperor on New Year Day, 1916, but a nationwide anti-Yuan war started. And that war started in Yunnan province, spread out to Sichuan, to Hunan, to several other provinces. So Yuan Shikai sent an army to suppress them, but not very successful. So at the same time, his restoration of monarchy drew criticism from many groups inside China and outside China, particularly from overseas Chinese communities. So in such a protest, a nationwide protest, and a nationwide civil war, so he abdicated in March 1916. So his interior endeavors totally failed.
He dies just a few months later from these illnesses that are likely exacerbated by the strain of dealing with all these crises. And as you've already explained, he has this long-standing negative historical reputation. What would you say is his, with the benefit of time and the reassessment that's been taking place, what was his true legacy as the leader of China?
There are many legacies left by Yuan Shikai. So one of the most important legacy is that ever since his failure in restoring the monarchy, so nobody in the future dared to do that again. So Chiang Kai-shek, the future leader of China, was more powerful than him. And he never intended to be emperor. And Mao Zedong was more powerful, but he dared not to crown himself the emperor. So that is one legacy. And other legacy Yuan Shikai left to China was his modernization endeavors. In his previous decades, positions as officials in the Qing Empire. And today, people begin to highlight his contribution to China, to Chinese national modernization, to Chinese national advancement. So in terms of economic development, industrial improvement, educational advancement, and many fields, he contributed a lot to China. So certainly, he built the first modern army. And those now were all seen as his positive legacies.
Well, we've taken up a lot of your time. Before we go, could you tell us what you're working on now?
Oh, throughout my scholarly life in the past 30 years, I just focused on Chinese transition from empire to republic around the 1911 revolution. I wrote many articles and co-authored books, and also wrote a couple of monographs. So this is the second monograph in English, and I wrote the first one, which was published about 4 years ago, that explores the immigration settlement in the Chinese frontier region. So that was a part of the transition between empire and republic as well. So in the future, I will continue to explore the transition of China from empire to republic by selecting several important topics. One of the topics right now I'm working is Chinese new cultural movement, which started in 1915 during Yuan Shikai's presidency. And this new cultural movement would significantly impact the Chinese mentality, culture, education, and the Chinese pursuit for modernity. And I will focus on that in the next few years.
Well, it sounds like a great project. I wish you the best of luck with it.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Patrick Chan, thank you for taking some time from your schedule to speak with us. I hope you have a wonderful day.
Oh, thank you for having me today. You have a nice day too.